Well, on that note, what are we?
How many minutes did we roll of us just chatting?
Of non.
Do you want to cut or do you want to?
No, I mean it'll edit.
You mean you will edit?
But this is episode 3.
Is it though?
Always the question.
We don't know what number it really is.
This is episode whatever it's labeled in your podcast player of Obscurigami. We're assuming the show is going to be called that. No, that's fairly
a pretty
certain.
Safe assumption.
Yeah, that's fairly certain at this point. But
there's a fair amount of evidence to back that
this
up.
This is the third episode of Obscurigami, the show where we talk about obscure things, obscurity, in general.
Yes.
Who knows?
People, places, things, nouns.
Who knows how
verbs,
it's going to
adjectives,
evolve.
Grammar.
I'm Thomas.
I'm Ben.
Ben has our topic for this week, and I have no idea what it is.
Right, so this is all going to be very exciting. Our topic this week is a Scotsman named Gregor MacGregor.
And I already love it.
it's off to a great start.
Yes.
Gregor MacGregor,
this is my first impressions.
Okay, first impressions before we reveal anything else about Gregor MacGregor.
He was a Scotsman?
He was a Scotsman.
Right.
By birth.
Yeah. I feel like he's already not very obscure because, like, MacGregor is the most unobscure Scotsman name.
You are correct.
You could possibly
come across. In that regard.
And he has it twice.
I think if you lived at a certain time in history, he wouldn't have been that obscure. So that's kind of that's something that we need to discuss.
Right. Contextually,
probably should have discussed before we got to this far.
How obscure is he?
Right, like, is obscurity relative to where we are in history, or like obscure
well,
in general?
I think honestly, you know, if we're gonna do, I'm assuming thousands of episodes of this podcast.
That's a safe assumption.
We really can't limit ourselves.
Oh, definitely.
Too heavily. In terms of what we consider obscure. So, you know, in 10 or 20 years, we might as well just be doing election news.
Right, right.
Because we'll have gone through basically everything.
So should we
obscure.
Start doing, like, current events now that will be obscure in the future?
Right. Probably.
Yeah.
That would probably be a good...
That's a good start.
Yeah. I think really... It's not what we talk about. It's just the fact that this is an obscure podcast. Very obscure at this point. Literally only 2 listeners.
I. Yeah, that's just perfect.
So
you just blew my mind.
As long as we keep our audience numbers low,
we're really, really hipster.
We will maintain obscurity. We can talk about whatever we want,
and be happy about it.
Yeah. But
so Gregor MacGregor was a Scotsman. He was born in Scotland, and he joined up with the British Army. Pretty early on, he started to develop an obsession with dress and medals and sort of flamboyancy. And when he left the army, he married a rich woman and started entering society and carrying on his flamboyance and his social... I don't know what the word would be. Carryings on.
Mm-hmm.
But when his wife died, he needed a source of income, so he decided to join freedom fighters in Latin America. And he was involved with Simon Bolivar, who was a freedom fighter for a lot of countries in South America. And he actually led a famous retreat to Barcelona, which is a city in Venezuela. And that's kind of what he was best known for. His unit that he fought with in the British Army became famous later on, and he would always claim that he was part of the unit when they were famous, even though he left long before. So he started to amass a reputation back in England as a soldier of some note.
Right.
Even though he was kind of a mercenary.
Yeah.
He did a campaign in Florida where he tried to take the colony of Florida from the Spanish with a bunch of hired British men, and it didn't go so well for him. And he, as things were headed downhill, he actually abandoned his troops and set sail on a ship to Jamaica, I think it was. And so he was not very popular with the people that survived of the people that he hired. And he repeated this stunt a couple different times in different places. But eventually he gets awarded some land by a king in modern day Honduras. And this king is kind of like a nominal king. It's a British colony, but right. they give a native person command so that they can say that they are self-governing. And it amounts to about 8 million acres of jungle that's not farmable. It's not really habitable. You can't work the land, basically.
How much is 8 million acres?
It's what? Like 12,000 square miles, I think.
Apparently it's as much as wildfire can burn in the U.S.
Whoa.
In 2015.
The reference that I have here says it's an area larger than Wales.
Other notable 8 million acre things are there's 8 million acres of farmland in China now too polluted to grow food.
That's useful.
It doesn't really give me any context for how big
right.
8 million acres really is. But
it is 12,500 square miles.
Okay.
So it's a pretty big area
right.
that he trades for rum and jewelry. So it's obviously not... It's a lot of area, but it's not very valuable land.
Yeah. He
basically bought this land. He traded
right,
for it.
Right. But the king gave it.
Right.
Gave it to him.
Right.
For rum and jewelry.
And so he being, you know, the sort of person that he is...
Gregor McGregor.
Being Gregor McGregor and having a tendency to claim rather ridiculous things about himself, he announces himself in London society as the cazique of Poyet. Poyet being this land that he owns in modern-day Honduras. And it's not... There's nothing really there. I can't really emphasize that enough. there's nothing there. There's no establishment. But he starts telling people that there's a city there called St. Joseph that has a royal palace and a system of government and roads and a bank, a national bank, and an opera house and a theater. Basically making out like there's
right.
there's a whole country there that he rules effectively as cazique, which is like a local word meaning prince. So he sort of dons this identity and he develops insignias and uniforms and a coat of arms and a flag, the Order of the Green Cross, a knighthood that he could provide for people. You know, as a service, if you wanted to be a member of the Order of the Green Cross, you could, you know, come to him for it and he would sell it to you. And he starts, you know, making the round socially and everybody's really buying into it. And so he starts to sell...
Is he back in London at this point?
He's back in London.
He heads back
to... He heads back to the United Kingdom, really. He also does some work in Scotland. Which I'll get to. But, he comes back to civilization, to Europe.
Yeah.
In quotes, civilization. And he starts to con people. He starts writing certificates for land, saying this is land that you can go and farm and you can own it. And he starts selling them. They're totally worthless. And it starts out, they're handwritten, and then they graduate to printed certificates. And then he starts to sell government bonds on the London Stock Exchange. And this guy is so convincing that people believe him.
Yeah.
Like, this country is not implausible to people because they don't know much about the area. And the area is, like, constantly changing hands between, like, local people. And then, like, the French and the Spanish and the English are all trying to, like, gain footholds in the New World and start colonies.
Right. It's basically like a fiat government, like fiat currency.
Right, they had their own currency that was, I mean, printed in Scotland.
Right.
Like it was completely worthless currency. But he was claiming all sorts of ridiculous stuff, and he starts like a major advertising campaign to start bringing in colonists. and people would pay to buy land and travel over there, hire ships. And he creates this like printed leather book about Poye that has illustrations of this fictional land. He describes it as with a river running through it that is filled with globules of gold.
Wow.
There's so much wild game that you can feed your family for a week just by hunting for a single day, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
The land is fertile. The city is there. He actually claims that it's a resort destination for people in the Caribbean. They come there for spa treatments.
Right.
He's invented this paradise.
And it's pretty clear from early on that he's not intending, this is out of no intention of actually getting people to inhabit this place. Or is that of some dispute?
Well, the plot thickens.
Okay.
So he, after creating this detailed world that he's imagined.
Yeah, similar to a world depicted in music. This is loosely tied to the fictional works
of Magma.
Of Magma.
Very much so.
In depicting a world that doesn't exist.
Right. Only he did it in a language that people could understand.
Right. Yes.
And I think it's much more clear that the world of Magma is fictional.
Right. Yes.
Certainly to the audience, the intended audience of both artists. But nevertheless, having created all this detail, he goes to Scotland. In particular, he chooses Scotland because he's a native Scotsman and he thinks they'll trust him because he's Scottish.
Yeah.
And he starts trading them Poye and money for real money. And basically signing them up to go to Poye.
Right.
And so expeditions are arranged and ships are hired, and he actually sees off the ships. He has like 7 ships worth of colonists that are lined up ready to go, and 2 ships actually leave and head over there with about 250 colonists. And they were mostly people who were city dwellers, people from Edinburgh or did I pronounce that right? How do I pronounce Edinburgh?
Edinburgh.
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 He takes people from Edinburgh and London, and they're mostly tradespeople, so they're not like wilderness survival experts.
Yeah.
And they go down there on these expeditions, 2 ships full, make it, and they get there and there's absolutely nothing there. I mean, it's jungle everywhere. And so most of these people end up dying. There's only about 50 survivors. So it instantly turns into not just like a kind of hilarious money making scheme,
right,
but actually like a deadly crime.
Yeah.
And the various governments step in and intercept. There's more ships on the way, but they find out what's happened.
Yeah.
And they start intercepting them. And he flees to France. The survivors, when they make it back, actually, most of them leap to his defense and say that blame the happenings on the leader of the expedition.
Interesting.
So he was that successful.
Yeah.
That he actually convinced people who lost their own children that they had not been had.
Yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's quite an incredible story. He is put on trial in France. And 2 of his accomplices are with him. One of his accomplices has fled to the Netherlands and can't be extradited in time for the trial. And he was actually held for 6 months without charges.
Do you know what crime specifically he was being charged for? Because
I do not know.
Was it clear? Because to me, it's like, well, I mean, clearly sending people to their deaths. He's lying about what exists, but he does own this land.
Well, you know, it's not really clear to me whether or not they actually landed in land that he owned. And he certainly didn't have authority as a ruler of any kind of sovereign nation.
Yes, yes.
So he was giving people permission to colonize land that may have been his private land, but it was still under the jurisdiction of the local king who came out and said, I did not authorize this.
Yeah.
This is not okay. And this guy's a crook.
I guess this type of thing would fall under just general... I'm imagining, you know, something like this couldn't really happen today with the context of just the dissemination of information. The ease of travel would make something like this a lot more... It would be a lot harder for something like this to happen.
Yeah.
But I'm just imagining what category this type of crime would fall under.
If it's just today's world or in the world of that time?
Well, in either. If it's just kind of an umbrella of fraud or, you know... Are fraud laws so broad that they cover things such as impersonating, or not impersonating, but like there's not even words for it, pretending to be a nation, and then not being.
Well, I mean, there's definitely words, I'm sure, for, I mean, counterfeiting money.
Right. And that's clearly.
And selling bonds. Right. And he actually took out a $200,000 loan from a bank in London. Or £2,000
right.
loan from a bank in London that thought they were loaning it to a government.
So there's
definitely, even if you couldn't charge him with criminal charges, you could definitely charge him with financial charges.
Yeah.
Because many people invested their life savings in buying land that effectively they weren't buying. Conspiracy was one of the charges.
Conspiracy.
But what happened was him and two of his colleagues stand trial, but all the documentation of their work, a lot of key documentation, is with the guy in the Netherlands who can't be extradited. And they get themselves a really, quite frankly, badass lawyer who's just like, there's no way to prove that these three people are the ones who did anything wrong.
Yeah.
Like, it could have been anybody. They could have all been duped.
Yeah.
And he pleads this case successfully. McGregor himself gets acquitted completely of all charges. And the two gentlemen are not only acquitted, but they're actually, their names are stricken from the record for ever having been charged at all.
Wow.
The unfortunate fellow who was eventually extradited from the Netherlands was sentenced to 13 months in prison. a relative.
Yeah.
So, he goes on to continue to attempt various similar schemes, in fact, still using the name Poirier, in France, in the country where he was trying.
Yeah.
And then also in London, until eventually he retires to Venezuela, and he dies at the age of 58.
Wow.
That was...
That's a very boring story.
So, yeah. Now that we've bored you to tears.
Yeah. So my main takeaway from this is if I'm ever planning some sort of mass crime, is to focus in on a crime that really is beyond description.
I think it definitely would help you if there's not a prior... I mean, that's a huge part of law is looking at, I forget the legal term, but like prior cases. If your crime has not been committed yet, that definitely helps you.
So he went back to Venezuela. He retired in Venezuela.
He did, yeah.
The land he was given was in Honduras?
Modern-day Honduras.
Honduras.
Yeah, so it would be... I'm not sure what country it would be at that time. I think they would have called it New Granada.
But he never even himself settled there.
No, it was, from what I understand, it was basically impossible to settle there.
Right.
Because it was heavily forested.
Yeah.
And the land was not suitable for cultivation.
Right.
It was wilderness.
Yeah. That's it takes a special kind.
It definitely does. The boldness, the audacity of it is what really staggers me. That he could just walk into a place of, you know, where there's a party, there's a social gathering, and just completely fool people. I mean, he could walk into a bank and convince them to give him a loan.
Yeah.
He could actually sell on the London Stock Exchange, sell bonds for a government that did not exist.
Yeah. But means of verification would have been so much weaker.
Yeah.
And you know.
And literally all the proofs he produced himself.
Right.
And I mean, he hired people to write songs and would have them sing it in the streets to like promote it.
Yeah.
And he, his wife, his second wife, was from Venezuela, and he sold her as a native of the country. So he claimed that he was descended from lineage of the land.
Yeah.
Which is interesting too, because he goes to Scotland later and uses his Scottishness to convince them.
Yeah.
But so in one sector of society, he's portraying himself as this native descended exotic leader, king, and then he goes back to another place and portrays himself as, you know, a native
of
Scotland.
Do you know, was France was just the particular country that
he wound up in,
ended up cracking down on him, or
that's where he
was when
got caught? They were the ones who actually imprisoned him.
Okay.
So I'm not sure if there were French people that were involved. Well,
and
but
France does have that guilty until proven innocent thing going on, so
they definitely all of the major European powers had a vested interest in South American colonies.
Yeah.
At the time. This would have been the 1820s. So Shooky darns.
Well, on that note, that's Gregor MacGregor.
It's an exciting story.
Quite the tale. There should be a good movie made about that.
It does feel like a potential story for a movie to me.
You could probably take a lot of creative license.
Yeah.
You know, change some things up, but
there's one of the key sources is a book called The Land That Never Was by Sinclair. And I haven't read the book, but it's cited pretty much everywhere online.
What amazes me is his actual ownership of this 8 million acres really doesn't enter into any of his schemes later on. It's like I'm just, you know, surely that inspired him to create this micronation, but he almost certainly could have gotten away with the same thing had he not even owned the million acres in the first place.
Right. Yeah.
So that's just it's just an intriguing detail to me that it's like...
Yeah, I mean, and it's not just that he came up with this scheme and then did it. The man was a fraud. Like, everything about him was fake. Like, he started exaggerating more and more, like, his lineage. He claimed... At first, he started claiming that he was the chief of the Scottish clan, the Gregor clan that he came from. And then eventually he started claiming that he was descended from royalty, and it just got more and more out of control.
Right.
His hubris was just amazing. And like, he had no problem at all with the idea of abandoning his own troops as a general for hire on a campaign that he sort of initiated.
Yeah.
And just, you know, basically leaving them all to die when things went south. So it wasn't just like he was a con man who pulled a con. It was like his whole life was a lie. And it makes me wonder how much of it he actually believed.
Right.
And I think he must have believed
parts of it.
Because, I mean, he took people into his confidence so completely. Like, imagine losing your entire family and then having government authorities tell you that you've been tricked and still not believing it.
Yeah.
And blaming somebody else.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. But so much more was based on, like, honor and respect of a person. The idea of, like, a king that was kind of ordained in almost a supernatural way as being a specific thing, and then you had loyalty to that.
Yeah.
Was a much more pervasive idea. And so, like,
honor-based culture.
I imagine you could so much more thoroughly, like, trick people into just buying wholesale.
Especially if you put that much effort into it.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, they invest some stuff, they invest some money, some time. You have to think there's a certain amount of, like, sunk cost fallacy going on where they're like, well, we've, you know, our children have died.
Mm-hmm.
This cannot be like, it cannot be that we were tricked. Like, right. There must have been something else gone wrong in this situation.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a...
It's quite incredible. He's been written about in The Economist as the father of securities fraud. Sort of the ancestor of Bernie Madoff.
Very interesting.
The founder of the Ponzi scheme.
Shall we hit up a random Wikipedia article? See what we come across.
This concludes the first portion of the show.
And continues on to the second portion. We should have a name for this bit. I feel like something pithy like Ben and Thomas click a random Wikipedia article.
I think what I like about that is that it's not too descriptive.
Right. It's kind of, it leaves it open.
We could
do different things with the segment.
You can interpret that a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
I think we should have our listeners write in and name the segment.
That's a good idea. So if you have ideas for what to call this segment,
or any segment
of the show,
or if you have any ideas,
or really if you just want to name the show, that's probably advice we won't take, but you can still give it.
You can still give that. If you want to give advice on who we should vote for,
right?
We'll send you to our spam box.
Feel free to submit that. We still don't have contact information.
Right.
So you'll have to find that.
Email us at track
that down. Well, I'm not going to go back in and add it in later.
Oh, you're not?
Almost certainly not.
Well, I might add it into the show notes later.
Okay. Well,
I create the mythical show notes.
I'm not going to edit it back in, but Ben might add it to the show notes. So check there if you really have just a burning fire
if you care
getting in touch with us. All right. But on to this yet-to-be-named segment where we click.
Did you push the button?
Wikipedia. I did. And it brought us to Fort Tehran? Tehran? Tehran.
They're alternative names.
I mean, that's just showing it without the accent. Anyway, Fort Tehran was a former Mexican military post and Texican settlement located in Tyler County in East Texas.
I think that's pronounced Texian.
Texian?
Texian?
Yeah.
You're settlement?
Right. You're probably right.
Where is Tyler County in East Texas?
It's in East Texas.
Shh, you're not participating.
Here are the coordinates. It's at 31 degrees, 1 foot, and 44 inches north, 91 degrees, 28 feet, 5 inches west.
Wow, that was really precise. What's near there? Orient us.
Zooming out.
It's worth the extra work.
Woodville, Livingston. I'm not familiar with Texas. It's...
How close is it to Dallas?
It's northeast of Houston.
It's west of Louisiana.
Southeast of Dallas.
South of Arkansas.
So there's Dallas... Then Houston is below Dallas. I'm going to describe this for podcast listeners. So imagine you're looking at a map of Texas.
All right, close your eyes.
Close your eyes. Imagine you're looking at a map of Texas. There's Dallas.
If you're driving, don't close your eyes.
There's Dallas kind of in the middle-ish of Texas.
Right.
Then down towards the right bottom corner of Texas, you got Houston. Then up, go between those two.
Wait, right? Like looking... From the inside of planet Earth out?
No. This is a space eye view.
Space eye view.
Yes. A moon's eye view. All right. So you imagine those two points.
Right.
Then go about a third of the way up to Dallas from Houston.
How long would it take us to get there from Houston? Let's do a quick Google map.
Well, here, let's do directions.
Yeah.
Directions.
Your wife thinks we should guess.
Houston.
How long?
Oh, okay. Be? You guess.
I think 5 hours.
5 hours drive from Houston.
I'm gonna guess.
I'm guessing 1 hour and 49 minutes. 2 hours and 22 minutes.
Mm.
It's 2 hours. It's 136 miles from Houston.
Well, clearly, don't listen to any estimates from me on how long your journey is gonna take.
It was other pithy facts about Fort Tehran.
Yeah.
It was named after General Manuel Meer y I'm not gonna say it.
Yeah,
let's... can't pronounce anything. Yeah, there's a lot of Mexican names in here that I can't pronounce. just browsing this very short article to see if there's anything. Okay, here's the most interesting bit. Okay. During the Battle of Nagadoches, the early stages...
I'm sorry, what?
Nagadoches? Nagadoche, you say it.
Nope. Nagadoches.
In the early stages of the Texan Revolution.
Uh-huh.
The Mexican garrison at Fort Nacho Douches fled south past the site where they were accepted by a band of Texans.
They fled south from their Nacho Douches.
Texian rebels.
Texian.
As the custom, rumors of the hidden or abandoned gold led to a number of excavations at the site. As the custom. Including one in 1954 where a man was killed by a premature explosion of his dynamite.
Whoa. So was there actually gold there, though?
Well, it was a custom. It was the custom. That section is not... That whole paragraph of Wikipedia, not cited.
Is this one of those, like, fake legends? Like, is any of that real? Was there a real battle of Nagadoches?
It was, in fact, a real battle. Okay. August 2nd, August 3rd, 1832.
Okay.
And everybody knows that.
Right. Was there a Mexican regiment that left their gold?
Well, I'm telling you, it's on Wikipedia, but it's not cited.
Right.
So
that's all we know.
Who knows? Yeah. The site is now abandoned. The fort.
The website Wikipedia?
No. The fort. It's now abandoned, and the nearest town is Rockland on US Route 69.
So is this like a place that we could like go and see? Is there like a historical marker there and you just keep driving? Whoa. That's such a marker.
We pulled open a webpage, www.tamu.edu/faculty/ccbn/dewitt/fitftteran.htm.
For the full URL, see the show notes.
Yeah. And it has a picture of what looks like an oversized tombstone with the words Fort Tiran and some other things on it. And yeah, it looks pretty pretty empty.
Oh, wow. Wow. So we just found a really desolate spot in Texas.
Yeah.
On Wikipedia. I guess statistically speaking, that was bound to happen sooner rather than later.
That's fairly obscure. As they go. Well,
as the crow flies.
That takes us to 44 minutes, likely to be edited down to 22. Episode 3 of Obscurigami. Are there any outgoing notes you have for the listeners, Ben, since you're in charge of the show notes?
I think all notes will be confined to the show notes.
Oh, I see. You don't want to do the show notes as a part of the show.
Oh, so did you want me to, like, read the show notes?
Well, I was hoping...
Because I haven't written them yet.
I was hoping you could do sort of audible show notes sort of a thing.
Oh, gotcha. So it's like a show notes audiobook.
Yeah. But if you would prefer to write down the show notes and include them along with the maybe in the metadata of the MP3 file, that would be acceptable as well.
I suppose we could tackle it that way. But, okay. I mean, why be, you know, so anti-traditional?
Right. Well, on that note,
that was my note.
Very good. See you next week.
Yeah.
Or
have
see you in the yet to be determined.
See you in episode 47.
See you on episode 47 where we talk about micronations.